Frederick Forsyth, the author who turned his adventures as a journalist and his work with MI6 into best-selling thrillers, has died after a brief illness, aged 86. He visited the RNIB Talking Book Studios a number of times, once to record a small non-fiction tale he wrote for us to help fundraise for our re-archiving project when we turned all our old quarter-inch tape recordings into digital files. He also popped in to record small messages of support like this.
Now, sight loss can happen to anyone at any time, and the RNIB is there to provide support when it does happen. Talking Books is described as one of the RNIB's most important services. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, visit www.rnib.org.uk.
On one visit in the early 2010s, I asked Frederick Forsyth why he supported Talking Books.
Well, I think two reasons. Firstly, I mean, I started reading as a boy and became completely smitten by the idea of reading, and I've never stopped reading. So I have a sort of personal obsession with reading. But the second thing, I think, obviously, is that I would just shudder with horror if someone said, "You're going to have your eyes taken away. You'll never see anything again." I mean, I think this must be one of the worst sort of maledictions. And so if anyone can do to help, those of us who have eyes, and I've just had operations on mine to give me back that 20/20 vision I used to have as a youngster. And I just think that if there's anything I can do to help people who have no sight, who want nevertheless to be entertained or informed or whatever via reading but can't read, this is the way. It's through the ears instead of through the eyes. And I do believe that you learn a lot of things through books, but mostly I find that you can retain if you've read it. Thus, I can retain what was in a book. I may well have forgotten what was in a film a few days after seeing it. But books, the written word on paper has something to do with clarity and memorability, and I can remember things that I've read years and years after I read them. Stuff I read at school, I can still recite poems I read at school, but I can't recall something that I saw visually a few days ago. So for me, reading is the way of educating a youngster and of retaining one's own interest in what's going on around one. I read newspapers, magazines.
Well, you mentioned newspapers, and you were a journalist in the 60s. What brought around the change of career and brought you to write The Day of the Jackal?
That's the best motivation probably that ever was. I was skint. I came back from a foreign correspondent, then a war correspondent, and I was down in Africa covering for 2.5 years, particularly violent and tragic African war, the Biafra War. And I came back from there and I found myself back in London, 31 years old, absolutely broke, no job, no prospects of a job, no car, no flat. I was actually crashing on the sofa of a mate, and I thought, what on earth do I do now? Well, answer, you've got to find some way of getting out of debt. So I was so naive, I thought that you wrote a novel and then sold it like a dozen eggs. Didn't realise, I didn't know about royalties and contracts and foreign rights and all that. I didn't even know anything about that. So I thought, well, what do I know? What can I write about? I know, what about that idea I had all those years ago in Paris when I was covering for Reuters the various attempts to assassinate Charles de Gaulle? And so I just sat down, untutored, instinctive, unlearned, and wrote. I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. I wrote on an old wallpaper table in this mate's flat. He went off to work. I sat down with a battered and much travelled portable typewriter, rolled in a few sheets of paper and started typing. And I just typed and typed and typed. And in 35 days, I had a manuscript. And amazingly, it is amazing, really. It's still not a line, not a word was changed. It's still exactly the same today. And I don't know how many millions it sold, but an awful lot. So a miracle, a minor miracle.
And did you imagine that a career as a writer could be so dangerous? Because you have been bugged, you've been interrogated, you've been shot at.
Well, there's some of these exploits actually preceded the novel writing. But what happened with The Jackal was that it was made very plain to me when The Jackal began to succeed that one of the reasons people liked it, apparently, was that it had a lot of explained technology in it, instead of just saying, oh, he reached into his pocket and produced a British passport, forged. I thought, hey, wait a minute, how do you get one? So I made it my business to find out, and I put it in the novel, and people ever since have been saying, that's how the so-and-sos get false British passports. and then I got lumbered, in a sense, with this reputation for, hey, you know, there's lots and lots of technology, and it's all explained. And this is the guy you've got to read if you want to know how spies work and how this works. So I got sort of really lumbered with the obligation to do a lot of research for each book and get it right, so that if I do get something wrong, boy, do I get letters.
Do you think the audio version of your books adds... Well, in fact, have you ever listened to any of the audio versions of your books?
Do you know, I haven't. It's funny. Once I've delivered them, after, say, the second or third read-through to the publisher, I don't read them again, and I've never listened to one. There was a man on that programme Mastermind some time ago, and his speciality subject was the novels of Frederick Forsyth. I thought, this I have got to listen to. Wow. He creamed me. He wiped the floor with me. He knew little characters back in books 25, 30 years ago that I'd long forgotten, and there he was answering one after the other. I was thinking, you know, this guy... Anyway, he beat the hell out of me.
Now, that's surprising, because The Afghan was a sequel to The Fist of God. Did you read any of it before?
It wasn't
quite
a sequel. It was the same man, but it was a different exploit. I mean, Mike Martin was I'd invented a question about that, but I did know that at the time of the first Gulf War, I believe we had three Special Forces officers in the country who could actually were so fluent in Arabic that they could pass for Arabs. Among Arabs, which, you know, that is so to speak, the pinnacle. If you can pass for French among the French, or German among the Germans, or Arab for an Arab among Arabs, you don't get more fluent than that. That's it, because it's everything. It's the accent, the gestures, the vocabulary, the slang, all sorts of things come into passing for something you're not. But anyway, I thought, well, we'll introduce this man into that book, which was called The Fist of God. And then years later, I think it was nearly 10, I thought, I need a Special Forces officer who can pass for an Arab. Well, I have one. His name's Mike Martin. He must surely now be in retirement. So sure enough, he was in retirement. I got him out of retirement to be the hero of The Afghan. But then I've done it more recently with The Cobra, which is the latest one. I've resuscitated two characters from Avenger. One CIA man and one ex-Vietnam war hero, both who appeared in Avenger and have now reappeared in The Cobra.
Now, you mentioned The Cobra, and I believe the research for that book was particularly hairy.
What happened was I felt I had to go to a particularly awful little failed state, now become a narco state, on the west coast of Africa, called Guinea-Bissau. Formerly the colony Portuguese Guinea, and wrecked by 20 years of war of independence, followed by years more of civil war, just a gutted ruin of a country that is now a major importer of cocaine. The stuff comes from Colombia across the Atlantic to this place, Guinea-Bissau, and then it's broken down into smaller packages and then smuggled north through the Sahara or over the Sahara and into southern Europe and eventually, I suppose, you know, to Mayfair. Or Edinburgh, for God's sake. So that's how it gets into this country. I thought I must have a look at this place and these people and the Colombian drug lords who infest the place. So I went down there. What I didn't know was that while I was actually airborne on the airliner from Lisbon to Guinea, a coup d'etat took place. And I landed right in the middle of it. So I swear I had not come for the coup. I'd come for the cocaine. But I got mixed. No, I got mixed up. I just became an inadvertent witness to a rather bloody coup d'état.
Wouldn't research be easier with a book or a laptop, maybe in front of the fire, maybe with a brandy?
Yes, they would be safer assuming the brandy. But then there are things about a place that you can get which you're not going to get online. There are anecdotes, people you meet, and the anecdotes they tell you, and you might get an interview with the chief of police or something. Well, he can tell you things that you're not going to get online at all, and that virtually no other researcher would get, because they wouldn't know what they were to ask for, what to look for. And there's a way of going to a place and learning about it. Small details, the names of streets, and you can get that off Google Earth, but you can't get the interviews and you can't get the special effects, so to speak, of a place. So where I have to describe a place that somebody else may not have been, I try to go there. Or 90% of the time I try to go there. But going to Guinea-Bissau was probably being a bit stupid, actually, because apart from the coup d'etat, I also picked up a blood poisoning infection in the left leg. They nearly took my leg off. Not down there, back in Harley Street. I got to Harley Street just in time. And they poured industrial quantities of antibiotics into me and saved the leg. But I thought, enough's enough. My wife said, you're insane. So I said, you're probably right, darling. But anyway, I did it. So if you read the Cobra, the bit about the coup d'etat, I thought, well, as I've witnessed one, I might as well put it in the book. So I put it in the book. The whole description of Guinea-Bissau in the book is absolutely spot on accurate. So may I advise you, cancel the vacation. You won't like it.
And finally, why should people support RNIB and RNIB Talking Books?
Well, I support any group of people like yourselves who are trying to help someone. Why indeed? I don't know. I suppose it's about that part of all our spirits that says, hey, you know, I am actually doing quite well. And if there is a God, and some people still believe that there is, despite Mr. Dawkins, then the good Lord has been very, very decent to me, and he's given me a cracking pair of eyes and good ears and a decent body and so on, or not, as the case may be. But those, I think, of us who are reasonably fit with good vision and hearing, etc., we have a feeling inside ourselves, at least I do, that there are some people who just don't, and there's a moral obligation to help. So if people can't see, I think we who can should say, you lucky so-and-so, and help this guy. And that's what RNIB does. We have tens of thousands of people in this country who are genuinely completely blind. They cannot see, but they can enjoy life. And part of that enjoyment comes from listening to cracking good stories, not through the eyes, but through the ears. Hence, the Talking Books program of RNIB is well, well worth supporting. So I urge you to do it if you can.
The best-selling thriller author Frederick Forsyth, who has died at the age of 86.